Radio.
Pope Francis's Vision of Gender. A presentation by Father Richard Umbers at the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2016 Colloquium.
So I'm going to talk about Pope Francis and his vision of gender. Sort of contextualizing a little bit the Pope's theology, which is a task in itself, is it's a restatement. He restates traditional Catholic teaching. But the preference he gives to that, though, is to the poor, to the simple, you know, the anabim, I would imagine, you know, as a locus for theological interpretation. It's the so-called teología del pueblo, which is one of a family of liberation theologies to have emerged from Latin America. How would you translate teología del pueblo? Theology of the common man? Something like that. But what it does is it looks to the practices and piety of the common people, free from the bourgeois concerns of the learned and clever, you know, who are often the proponents of an ideological colonization. So you think of the pressure that's brought to bear by rich world governments and their representatives on poorer countries as regards reproductive rights or the way in which they push forward LGBTQI issues. So now the ultimate praxis, obviously, for a Catholic is the lex orandi. In Catholic faith, we've always distinguished men from women in the way that we have celebrated certain of the sacraments. I'm not just talking here of certain cultural practices. I know even today in some countries you see that the men sit on one side of the church and the women sit on another. I've seen that in rural Vietnam. And you see it other, you know, more traditional places as well. But I'm not referring to that. Rather, we're looking at the point of, in a baptism, you have God fathers and God mothers. Marriage is between a man and a woman. Holy orders, even the office of acolyte, which is not in holy orders, but it's reserved to men. So in the church's own practice, and this has been for centuries, we've always made these distinctions. Now, the Pope, in his encyclical Evangelii Gaudium, points 103 to 104, refers to certain what you could might call them essentialist features of women. What is referred to since John Paul II as, you know, the feminine genius. And at the same time, he takes into account that the only men may be priests. So it's always interesting to see what the Pope has actually said or what he's actually written, as opposed to perhaps the general media narrative of who Pope Francis is. Because the thing is, there's a lot of things that the Pope says and does which doesn't get reported. It doesn't get commented on. You go, well, no, but the Pope said that. You know, they go, oh, no, it doesn't fit the narrative. You know, so we'll leave that to one side. But so he says here that the Church acknowledges the indispensable condition which women make to society through the sensitivity, intuition, and other distinctive skill sets which they, more than men, tend to possess. I think, for example, of the special concern which women show to others, which finds a particular, even if not exclusive, expression in motherhood. The Pope is outlining certain aspects that one attributes to women. He goes on to say also, too, the reservation of the priesthood to males as a sign of Christ the spouse who gives himself in the Eucharist is not a question open to discussion. Reaffirming John Paul II, you know, when he said, you know, this question is, you know, it's solved, you know, it's not to be asked. Francis is the same thing. So feminists would rail against these sorts of teachings as institutionalization of patriarchy, heterosexism, to the detriment of women and homosexuals. And what may seem like common sense to many ordinary people, feminists would argue, is a mask for historical forces that have served to oppress certain groups. And look, the sooner we are brought to that realization through this consciousness raising, the better chance we have to make socially advantageous changes. That's more or less where they would be coming from. Now, more specifically, if you bring Marx into the picture, Marx would speak of capital and alienation of the working class. With that kind of a thrust in feminism, you have an unmasking as well. In this case, of that binary, what they call, you know, a binary logic where you have labeling male and female, or where you have a gender essentialism. So, you know, you might say that is a man's job or this is woman's work. And really what's going on there is that this is the oppressing class getting what they want using these sorts of structures. How does it happen? One example of how things work could be that, well, men not only value capital, you might say, or material goods, men value love. But by controlling the structures that surround love, men can seek to exploit women's erotic and caring powers, their life force, without giving back to women in the same measure. So there's an inequality of commerce. Women are thereby systematically impoverished in their socio-sexual stakes. Men are seen as independent, women are seen as dependent, and they're dependent on men. The very abilities and values of women are held to have originated from men. The authority of men is upheld on the basis of quashing the worth and excellence of women. Men can hold back, but women have to depend upon just one man for love and will settle for exploitative conditions in order to obtain that love. So just as a capitalist is vulnerable, however, to a worker's strike, you might want to argue that when a woman withdraws her love and erotic affection, she can show the man who's who. Have you come across the term woke? You know, social you all know social justice warriors. You've all heard that term, I would imagine. So someone who is socially justice aware is known as woke. You know, there's a woke person. So I was going to say, you know, a woke woman doth a woke man make. But then the argument is, but does it lead to real change, though, on the part of the man, or is he simply just strategic lip servicing, you know, in order to be able to then to get whatever it is that, that he should desire, as per the old ways? So this is the war that men and women have been fighting since Genesis 3. But this new way of seeing what it means to be sexually human is best illustrated, I think, with Tumblr. You know, Tumblr. Anyway, there's a very popular image on there of the genderbread person. If we can we get the genderbread person, or can you see the? It's a big genderbread man, basically, with that. But it explains how people are sort of reshaping the way that we view not just man and woman, but, you know, all sorts of opportunities and possibilities. If you look at, I mean, one of the clear distinctions made is, for instance, that between sex and gender. If you look at the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, it attributes that distinction to the work of a psychologist, Robert Stoller, from 1968. He was seeking to explain why people felt trapped in the wrong body. And so he started to use this term sex to say, well, that's the biological trait, and gender to say that's the amount of femininity or masculinity that a person exhibits. It strikes you as being very sort of Cartesian in the dualism. But it did allow him to explain that phenomenon of transsexuality. So you can have a transsexual sex and gender just don't match. Now, feminists could agree with him that gender is socially constructed, but what they won't be able to agree on is how it is socially constructed. And there you start to get divisions of opinion. So second wave feminists like Janice Raymond really struggle with the trans aspects of gender as a potential time bomb even for feminism. And she writes, these are quotes I've taken from an article on this, is individual gender suffering relieved at the price of role conformity and the perpetuation of role stereotypes on a social level? In changing sex, does the transsexual encourage a sexist society whose continued existence depends upon the perpetuation of these roles and stereotypes? Many of the times, you know, here we go, there's the genderbread person, if you can see here. So you can see that sex is something biological. Identity is a matter of what you decide in your brain, how you feel. Attraction is obviously just, well, where the heart leads. And then, well, you've got expression, so you can talk about gender as performative. That's Judith Butler, you know, anyway. So there's all your possibilities there with the Tumblr version of what it is to be human. Because the thing is that there are certain YouTube personalities who are who show how they transitioned, and it's quite something. I mean, there's often, at least at the YouTube level, there's often a great emphasis upon trying to accentuate what would be stereotypical roles for what you would consider male or female, in that sense, in the way that they present, and so that of course, you know, raises the heckles of someone like Janice Raymond. Okay, now, Judith Butler, who's a very well-known feminist, a queer theorist, I suppose you could say, dismisses those claims. She would say that this is the prejudice of a trans-exclusionary radical feminist, a TERF. So, and she writes in here, so I think it's incumbent upon all of us to get rid of these approaches that are the TERFs. They are painful, unnecessary, and destructive. Raymond sets herself up as the judge of what transsexuality is and is not. We are already in a kind of moral prison as we read her work. What's much more important than any of these behaviorist or moral approaches are all the stories, poems, testimonies, the theoretical and political works, the document that struggled to achieve embodied self-determination for individuals and for groups. What we need are poems that interrogate the world of pronouns. As this, if any of you had seen, there was a conference for certain Democrats a year ago. They were talking about the death of the bees. If you came across that, it was actually relatively humorous, the whole thing anyway. I mean, the poor bees, okay? I mean, I'm happy for the bees, but everything was all, you know, the whole political conference was about, you know, drawing poems out of the death of bees. So this is this, you know, telling your stories. Poems that interrogate the world of pronouns. That's a whole big area. It opens up possibilities for language and life. Forms of politics that support and encourage self-affirmation. What we need is a political and joyous alternative to the behaviorist discourse, the Christian discourse on evil or sin, the convergence of the two in forms of gender policing that are tyrannical and destructive. So there's these sorts of arguments that Judith Butler makes, I have heard used again and again by different activists. There was a debate recently in Sydney with John Haldane and various transsexual activists. I don't know if you were aware of that. It was the IQ Squared, one of those things. But the arguments used then came from Judith Butler. So an alternative perhaps to this gender-bred person image could be that of licorice all sorts. So that although Raymond was saying, well, you know, they're sort of hyping up the stereotype. I mean, you can have butch trans women. You can have femme trans men. You can have transitioning agender. You can have non-binary. In the end, though, it really starts to... There was a great little YouTube video. If you YouTube 60 different genders, you'll get a German politician. Speaking, I don't know if you've seen him going where he says, dare this, dare that, dare the other. I mean, it becomes a reductio ad absurdum in the end. You know, it just goes on the list of... the mind boggles, you know, and that's really the only limit. So Pope Francis is well aware of these sorts of disputes, even within feminism itself. And he will go out of his way to treat homosexuals and transsexuals with affection and respect. That's very important. But when it comes to the teachings of the church on these matters, he doubles down on the male-female distinction. And he considers the elimination of those differences a failure. So to eradicate the male and female identity does nothing to solve the problem, or unfair or disrespectful treatment based on a person's gender. So in one general audience that he was giving, you know, catechesis on the family, he said, getting rid of the difference is the problem, not the solution. I wonder if so-called gender theory may not also be an expression of frustration and resignation that aims to erase sexual differentiation because it no longer knows how to come to terms with it. With gender theory... A gender theory that argues that sort of being male or female is a largely malleable social construct, he says we risk going backwards. So what is he really getting at with that? Well, I think there's a very long passage from Amoris Laetitia in chapter 2. It's a remarkable document, that exhortation. But he becomes a lot more specific about what he means on this, what he was saying in the catechesis. If you bear with me, I'm going to read a reasonably long paragraph. But this is Francis. And so if you want to understand the mind of Francis, I mean, he has written it down here. Okay, so this is number 56 of Amoris Laetitia. Okay, it says, yet another challenge is posed by the various forms of an ideology of gender. So we're already putting this in Francis's thought. I mean, it's an ideology that denies the difference and reciprocity in nature of a man and a woman and envisages a society without sexual differences, thereby eliminating the anthropological basis of the family. You can see what's at stake with this. This ideology leads to educational programs and legislative enactments that promote a personal identity and emotional intimacy radically separated from the biological difference between male and female. I mean, it's taking place in Australia with safe schools and in other areas as well. So there's definitely a real consequence for our society from these sorts of thoughts. It's not just simply a question of saying, oh, well, look, you know, let people believe what they believe, do what they do, it's all good. Of course, inevitably, there's going to be a political ramification to this, and even upon our own abilities to teach what we believe to our own people within our own faith traditions. It impacts. Consequently, human identity becomes the choice of the individual, one which can also change over time. It is a source of concern that some ideologies of this sort, which seek to respond to what are at times understandable aspirations, manage to assert themselves as absolute and unquestionable, even dictating how children should be raised. You can see what Pope Francis is getting at with this. You know, I mean, it's one of those aspects where, you know, you take what is actually relative and you make it absolute. In these cases, you know, it's all generally we say, well, you believe what you believe, I believe what I believe, and that. But in these things, there is no discussion. And in fact, you know, I love Twitter. I love sort of, you know, tweeting around and seeing what others are up to with Twitter, because I don't like to live in an echo chamber. Twitter is certainly no echo chamber, depending how you use it. But I'm very, very wary to talk about these sorts of things, because there is only one answer for now. Maybe in a couple of years' time, there'll be a different answer, but because, you know, people are quite absolute on this. He goes on to say, it needs to be emphasized that biological sex and the sociocultural role of sex, gender, can be distinguished but not separated. On the other hand, the technological revolution in the field of human procreation has introduced the ability to manipulate the reproductive act, making it independent of the sexual relationship between a man and a woman. In this way, human life and parenthood have become modular and separable realities, subject mainly to the wishes of individuals or couples. It is one thing to be understanding of human weakness and the complexities of life, it's being pastoral, and another to accept ideologies that attempt to sunder what are inseparable aspects of reality. Let us not fall into the sin of trying to replace the Creator. We are creatures and not omnipotent. Creation is prior to us and must be received as a gift. At the same time, we are called to protect our humanity, and this means, in the first place, accepting it and respecting it as it was created. I mean, this is the thought of Francis, this is the thought of the Church. And listening this morning, this is also the thought of other faith traditions from coming from Abraham. And certainly, this is, you know, in fact, what was behind the Pope's encyclical on creation, Laudato Si. It's not the climate change encyclical, there's a lot more going on. We just pay into respect for God's handiwork. It links the problems that beset the environment with the poor and with man himself. You know, when you are not giving worship to God, when you're not respecting the order of creation, when you're not reading into creation what God has written there. So you get all these problems that come from individualism and consumerism, and, you know, the Pope talks about, you know, when the heart's empty, it's not filled with the worship of God, then it starts looking to consume more and more and more and creating all of these difficulties. So it doesn't mean that the Pope's not open to having a further discussion on this, but it does mean that that discussion is going to take place along certain lines. He's making it clear what those lines are. Now, in Evangelii Gaudium, in paragraph 221, he sets forth four principles for what he says are fundamental parameters of reference for interpreting and evaluating social phenomena. And I'll talk about those. One, time is greater than space. It can be taken in different ways. I was trying to read a book by Catherine Pickstock of Radical Orthodoxy fame on liturgical time being greater than secular space. And I did get through the book after writing. Near the end, though, I was going, what am I reading? It's upside down, around the way. It was a critique of Derrida. And you know, if you can understand Derrida, well, good on you. And she seems to, but she's critiquing him. And then I was seeing other people critiquing her because Derrida's like, wow, this is too much. So I have to leave that one to side. But at least I can say, like, accepting seeing creation as a gift to respect, including our bodies. And this is a point made in Laudato Si at paragraph 155. But it calls for a recognition also that there is a tension between fullness and limitation. I like very much in chapter 9 of Amoris Laetitia. So I know chapter 8 is the controversial one, but moving past to chapter 9, he talks about, you know, the patience that spouses need to exercise in regard with each other. You know, that perfection's only going to be in heaven. Don't you know, in the Laudato Si, the Pope's always saying, look, don't ask of things more than they can give. Like, creatures are creatures. Don't ask them to give more than they can give. They're limited. You know, respect them as coming from God, love them, but don't put a burden on them that's more than what they can do. So with an embodied perspective, our position in space, because we are bodies, we also move through time. You know, we are on a journey to perfection, and we need to be patient. We need to be accepting of our bodies, and in the interaction of a family made up of women and men, building up habits and virtues in anticipation of a fulfillment that we'll only reach in heaven. So the right way to solve problems and conflicts in this male and female relationship is to have men and women, and he says, to talk to each other more, listen to each other more, know each other better, care more for each other. If conflict arises between the sexes, it's because of a loss of faith in God as a father. That's how the Pope puts it. When we're separated from God-given reality, our discourse can fall into rhetoric and manipulation of the truth. And that's, I suppose, where sometimes, you know, the Pickstock argument would be that secular discourse spatializes time. Laudato Si also sees it that way when the Pope talks about a hermeneutic of technology. What happens is that, you know, we've got to be very careful with our use of technology that it not lead us to become beguiled, where the way in which it shapes our environment facilitates, I suppose, this thing, the immediate desire, immediate connection. I just have to click for eBay or click for Amazon, or, you know, a drone thing is going to come along and drop the book off eventually. I don't know whether the drones are going to start running into each other, but the thing is that, you know, that where, you know, the idea of patience and restraint and love and gift, you know, we need to do more to bring those very important attitudes to life to the forefront. So if there's a trend to certain biological solutions of near infinite malleability to accord with our own interior impulse, we need to make objective judgments on those choices. It's not enough simply to say, well, I choose. We need to be able to judge the choices from an objective perspective. Okay, that's time is greater than space. Another point is realities are greater than ideas. I know that itself is an idea. I know that. But anyway, but realities are greater than ideas. So the Pope writes, it's dangerous to dwell in the realm of words alone, of images and rhetoric. But that's the danger that we face if there's no objective standard or benchmark or a reality created from an intelligent creator. Quite often in traditional metaphysics, you talk about man as being governed by reality, but reality is governed by the mind of God, you know, the measure. The measure of reality is the mind of God. Protagoras would have said, you know, man is the measure of all things, but what we're looking at here is it's God's mind, whether we're revealed in nature or in scripture, which is the measure for reality, and the reality has to be our measure. So the way that we interpret our bodies is in reference to God's design. And it's here that we're, in fact, if we look at some of the latest work in feminism, there's been a turn back to nature in some ways and a challenging of what you might say call an anti-categorical assumption. Because in much of the work of Judith Butler or other feminists, there's a real antipathy to the use of terms like nature, or, you know, you know, what's denominated as gender essentialism, because obviously there they could see, oh, if we adopt that, you know, we are going to fall back into the clutches of patriarchy. But these feminists are saying there's no way around this. You know, if feminism is not to be a utopia, we've got to acknowledge reality. We've got to acknowledge nature. There is something about being a woman. Even if we're saying, as women, we are being oppressed, there's something about being a woman for us to be oppressed in that way, you know, or not being treated. We're being oppressed qua women. So we've got to talk about that category. And there's a Swedish Marxist feminist by the name of, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, Lena Gunnarsson. And I can't even tell you the name of the city where she lives. It's not Stockholm. I can't pronounce it. It's got letters and things. My brother knows Swedish. I'm going to have to ask him. But she's really taken Butler to task for stigmatizing the category of woman. And she says, look, if men and women are of equal ability and worth, it's implying in some way that there has to be a stable ontological reality. And I'll quote her. She says, this ontological tension is at the heart of the feminist project and cannot coherently be made sense of without a notion of natural necessity, of a natural ontological order, on which any society must base itself and whose inherent structure and constraints will cause human suffering and unfreedom unless accommodated. We have to get with reality and the way in which we have been made. Now, she's not necessarily saying, you know, I'm a Pope Francis fan or anything, but there is this trend back to attending to the material, attending to the of what reality shows us. So although nature may evolve, because there's the dynamic in nature and everything, it does remain fairly stable. And if the feminist project should be taken seriously, that metaphysical commitment that biological sex brings with it has to be dealt with, rather than always, you know, strategically deferred, which is what Butler and others tried to do. She says, although women and men are more than women and men, you know, there's all sorts of you know, complex relations and forces that position you in different places. Nevertheless, it's still women and men. You know, they are still women and men. So Butler, one of the problems that Butler has, I think, and is made reference to here by Gunnarsson, is that she's dealing with an ontological problem, but does it with epistemological terms. So to say that we only know about sex through some culturally constructed system may or may not be the case. It doesn't mean that sex itself does not exist or that sex is a fiction. You know, sex has all those capabilities and that certainly there's a long tradition in Catholic thought, you know, with theology of the body, but also going back further than that, as regards to what sex is, and the same is true for other faith traditions, explaining the importance of sex and what it's about. Many times what happens here is that simply sex is just referred to almost in passing, and you get stuck in with all the power relations and as regards gender. And she said, no, we've got to talk about sex. Neither, says Gunnarsson, is transgression a good for its own sake. You know, many times with postmodernists, they say, you know, you have to sort of transgress the order and transgress this. And well, maybe, but as Gunnarsson points out, not all transgression liberates, and not all kinds of stability are oppressive. Think of the importance of the family. You know, we don't have to transgress the family. In fact, it's a good thing when you have a family. It's great for the children, for the reasons that we've been talking about earlier today. Okay, the third point of Pope Francis, unity prevails over conflict. This is a question we have to put. Look, if we're to treat everyone with dignity, how can we make the very vulnerable, and here especially we think of transsexuals, they're very vulnerable, how can we make them feel included? This is a pastoral challenge. And the Pope, I think, is asking us to sensitively deal with conflict head on, not to tiptoe around it or pretend it's not there. So we need to state clearly what we believe, even though, and at the same time, to try to receive. I think in other places, Pope Francis has pointed to a work of Pope Paul VI called Ecclesiam Suam, which deals with dialogue. And it provides us with a model of how to undertake dialogue. And that means that we don't speak from on high. We listen actively. We recognize the person. We attend to the evidence and the arguments that are given. You know, seriously. That's how dialogue goes ahead. And in that sense, I do agree with Judith Butler. Not completely, but I do agree with what she's trying to get at. She's honest when she says the following. You know, we don't have to agree upon the origins of the sense of self to agree that it is ethically obligatory to support and recognize, now, it's the recognize bit, but the support, yes, sexed and gendered modes of being that are crucial to a person's well-being. Some trans people have a strong sense of self bound up with their genders, and so to get rid of gender would be to shatter their selfhood. It's an important point. It's a very sensitive one, and I suppose it's along the lines that you can't knock down if you're not going to build up again. And Pope Francis speaks about this in other contexts with, you know, we should be, I don't know how he puts it, you know, getting bread, but actually throwing stones and that sort of thing, you know. It's about, we do need to be very pastoral. And that's, I would say, an argument, once again, in favor of marital and familial stability for the raising of children. That's how you're going to be pastoral. Because there, you raise people with a proper sense of identity, you know, the security that comes from being within a family. And it's incumbent then upon families themselves to reach out. You know, there are people who have houses but do not have homes. Well, those homes that we form, you know, allow us to then extend a hospitality that reaches out to others. And really, in the end, it's about charity. And that's what we bring as believers. You know, we bring charity. And it's so important. You know, many times, we live in a society here in the West where, you know, there's so much loneliness. It's crippling loneliness. It's one of the major problems that we face. Okay. And to finish with, the fourth point that the Holy Father makes is that the whole is greater than the part. Synergy doesn't mean eradicating differences. It consists, rather, in seeking to make a place for everyone. And then, this is the mathematician or the scientist in the Holy Father. He says, in the manner of, you remember that one? Polyhedron. so jarring. You're like, what? Anyway, but that's how he puts it. So our deepest identity is the one that Christ has won for us, I think, as children of God. And that category is the one that sort of, you talk about intersectional feminism, you know, because you have not just your experience as a woman, but you could have your experience as a woman of color. Or of a particular genderbred interpretation, or what? But whether you're a sinner or a saint or XX or XY or XXY, or Christ has made us all children of God. You know, and there we have that. You know, whom there is no longer male or female, Jew or Greek, slave or free. In the Book of Revelation, you know, it speaks about that white stone. You know, those who have wearing white, you know, their vestments in the blood of the Lamb. But also speaks about that stone that only your name is, you know, is written on it, that individual call as well before our Lord. And in heaven, of course, you know, there is no longer marrying nor giving in marriage. What you have is the marriage of the Lamb. And it's in the Mass that we remember that glorious future, you know, when God will be all in all in the Holy Mass. So it's the Church herself which is a family into which all are welcome, all are called. And the way that Archbishop Fisher puts it, he says, look, everyone's invited, but everyone's held to the same high standard. Okay. That's it.
That was Father Richard Umbers with Pope Francis's Vision of Gender. This presentation was part of the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2016 colloquium on the theme, The Nature of Men and Women, Complementary but Different, which was hosted in Hobart, Australia. For more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.